Friday, and welcome to episode 95 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into The Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off the week is Eric Nash of The Almost Famous Minute and Feels Like Weezer. Welcome back, Eric.
Hey, Rob. So glad to be back and to finish this week up.
Yeah, we finally actually get some dialogue to discuss. We don't just get to analyze the scenes. We get to actually analyze what people say along the way. So episode 95 begins with Danny extricating himself from being buried in the dirt and wood and goes all the way up to the point where Colin crumples up a piece of paper. As we discussed yesterday when we finished up episode 94, Danny was caught in an avalanche of dirt and wood coming down, you know, as he was digging, completely covered up. That's a lot of dirt that fell on him. You can imagine how difficult it is to try and get out of that. But as we mentioned yesterday, Charles Bronson's got a lot of guns. So he's, you know, not literally, in his arms. So he's able to pull himself out of that, which is pretty helpful, both for him and, you know, for everyone around him, that they don't have to try and pull him out. And we get to see him crawling over the dirt. You know, he looks like an ant.
Yeah.
You know, crawling out of the dirt and then over it. You know, the way that they show that.
Yeah, and before you noted the pieces, scraps of wood that are there in the mix too, you know, I mean, I almost wonder if that's, you know, could have been somehow helpful, you know, if there's wood involved, you know, that you know,
because the wood will catch part of the
dirt, like, yeah, it would kind of create some air pockets in a sense, maybe. Yeah.
Could be. Mm. Right. Now, the question is whether they use real wood here or these are just styrofoam pieces of wood. They move a little too easily. So my guess would be that they're not real. I don't think an actor would agree to have them throw pieces of heavy pieces of wood on them. But you never know. Maybe he was method acting.
Yeah.
You know, and
give it all to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Dirt and wood.
Completely. And then he's able to crawl out of this. And luckily, he's also going in the right direction. You know, he reaches the point where Willie can actually hear him. They can shout to one another. We don't know the distance between them.
Yeah. If he hadn't gotten turned around successfully and had been pointing the other way, you know, head first the other way, I mean, that would have been awful. Yeah, I mean,
right. I mean, there's another shot in the movie where Willie gets buried and they pull him out by his feet. So, yeah. Again, we never know the distance between the way station, you know, because here, you know, we have Willie and someone else, at least one other person in a, you know, in the way station. So is the way station, is there 150 feet between them or, you know, who knows? They never outright state, but, you know, they're also supposed to be quiet here. You know, they don't want the Germans to hear them. Just because you're underground doesn't mean that everything is soundproof. Mm-hmm. But they're screaming to one another. Are you all right, Danny? You know, thankfully Charles Bronson doesn't scream back because he's out of breath completely. He goes, yes, all right. You know, in his thick Polish, or thick fake Polish accent. And then he goes, bring some shovels. I'm all right. Which is basically showing us that you know, despite the fact that the tunnel has collapsed on him, he still wants to go continue on and persevere and make it through, which is nice to see, especially knowing the fact that he is claustrophobic. You know, he hasn't broken. He still wants to go through this and still wants to get out eventually. And you know, it says a lot about his character also. Once you know the fact, when you're watching these type of scenes, knowing the fact that he is going to be brought out as being claustrophobic in, you know, in a few weeks, it says a lot about what his character is willing to do in order to get out of this camp, to be buried alive so many times in this type of situation where it's your biggest fear. You know, we see the night before the big escape that he actually decides that he wants to get out on his own. You'd think that he would just have done that at any other point. Why is he waiting? You know, if he's that scared of of being buried alive and he's that claustrophobic, then why would he even put himself in that situation? That's what I would ask. But again, it comes down to, I guess, camaraderie and, you know, not being selfish, but actually being selfless and doing whatever you can to help everyone around you, which I think is a big theme of this film, which is why the ensemble cast works so well, because they all complement one another with their performances and with everything that they're doing.
Mm.
And so then we move along and we get to see, it's nighttime, and we see Colin Blythe using a magnifying glass to look at some piece of paper. We're not sure what it is. You know, as we know, he's the forger, so obviously he's checking a document that someone was able to put together and wants to use for the prisoners. And immediately he looks at it and he says, "Hey, for God's sake, Smitty, you left out a whole eagle." Which, you know, you'd think that would be pretty self, you know, that's something that someone would notice. You know, we're not talking about that. He didn't say you left out, you didn't dot your I or cross your
T. Or a feather of an eagle, the fourth feather on an eagle or something. Yeah.
No, well, that would be yeah. even too much, you know, to leave out an entire eagle. Wow. Smitty is not having a good day, that's for sure. Then he basically says to him, "That's impossible." You know, meaning that did my work. And then he takes from him something. Mm-hmm. Now, were you able to identify what he takes from Smitty's hand?
Mm.
Is it maybe the rubber stamp that they use to, you know, to copy off of or something?
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Okay, that would make a lot of sense.
That's my guess. You know, I know because my daughters use stamps. So, you know, you and that's the way a stamp looks. So that's what it could be. But what's interesting is the fact that Smitty's holding that in his hand before Colin takes it out. Like, why is he holding it in his hand?
Yeah.
As opposed to it just lying on the table or, you know, being around or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes it. You can see that this is the first time in the movie that Colin actually loses his temper. He's a very jolly fellow throughout the entire movie. Doesn't matter what situation, even later on when he's escaping, he's always jolly the whole time. You know, he's you never see him upset or depressed except for in this specific situation. Yeah, obviously he's a little depressed when they don't want to let him go, but he has his plan to make sure that he will eventually get out.
Did they kind of want, was the idea possibly having these two moments, the one for Danny here getting an avalanche of the dirt on him, and this issue with a part of the forging process, you know, a mistake there happening too at the same, you know, within this, you know, few moments of each other. Is that a good filmmaking technique to have had these two happen here at the same time practically, or would have been better to have them spread out a little bit more?
I think it's still effective doing it one after the other because they're showing that this isn't a simple process.
Mm-hmm.
That problems happen along the way, and that you deal with them and you move along.
Yeah.
In both of these situations, you see, Danny is buried. And then immediately he says, "All right, get some shovels. We're continuing forward." And at this mm-hmm. point, you know, we haven't gotten to what Colin's reaction will be here, because we're going to actually discuss that more next week. But it goes along the same line that, okay, you messed up, but we're going to continue doing this. This is, you know, that these are things that can't break you. Now, what I find interesting is the close proximity of these scenes to Ives' death, which we talked about at the beginning of this week, because there you have one of the characters who had a breakdown after a catastrophe, after Tom was mm-hmm. was found out. So this in some ways is showing the opposite effect, that just because things go south and don't work the way you want them to doesn't mean that everything is lost. So that's the way I look at it. What did you think about that? Do you think that it's in a good spot, or that it should have been spread out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think a little more spread it out because we had the good thing that kind of came out after Ives of you know, Hiltz really coming around.
Mm-hmm.
And even a success with that too, even additionally that he, you know, what he does escape and he then gets caught like he wants to. And, you know, he even lets, Attenborough's character know. Bartlett. Yeah. Yep. And then, you know, but then, you know, it shows some good success, a little bit of, you know, normal success with the tunneling. Even though there's just that little small avalanche at first, you know, that it shows and then it cuts away and we're away from, too. But, you know, yeah, it's, unless, I don't know, unless there's, it's even more bad stuff that happens. I mean, it would be nicer in a sense, maybe if there's a third thing after this, and I forget what is after this at this point, but you're kind of already hinting at it a little bit. So, kind of a rule of three thing would be nice, you know, in a sense, but, you know, otherwise, yeah. I'd say, you know, give me a little more bad or give me good in between these two is what I'd
okay, kind no, of want. I can understand what you're saying there, yeah. but maybe yeah. part of it has to do with the fact of the pacing of the whole movie, and because the movie is so long that you don't want to just throw in extraneous stuff. I mean, it's very important to show Danny being buried here, because later on we'll find out that he's claustrophobic, and it's very important to show Colin here because of the fact that he loses his eyesight right after this, basically.
Yeah.
And so we have a slight debate between Smitty and Colin, and, you know, Smitty doesn't think it's impossible. And then Colin says, 4 days work up bloody spout.
Okay. Yeah, okay, so it is spout. Yes. S-B-O-U-T. Yeah, okay. I was thinking spot. That didn't quite sound right. You know, what could that be referring to? Yeah.
That's right. That's why I always have subtitles handy.
Yeah.
Very important. Very important. I know in the minute files, you can't do that, but, you know, that's why I always have both up at the same time. He uses the phrase up the spout. Have you ever heard that phrase before?
Without the word bloody in it, that's the old little nursery rhyme, what have you, you know, song for Along Came a Spider.
Right. Okay, you know, but not that. That's not used in a way. That's not an exclamation.
No, yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know that the way he's saying it. Yes, sure. The truth is, I never even thought about the fact.
But anything going up a spout, which, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, our what we have in America, at least our drainage systems from our roofs, you know, a downspout, you know, and I just imagine, you know, things going up it, and that's probably a bad thing.
So, you know, I mean, I
whether it's a spider or something more clog inducing.
Yeah. That's true.
Maybe.
I mean, I looked it up, and what I found was that the phrase is actually a slang expression from the British Isles from many, many years ago. Specifically say when it was. There were quotes of people using it already in the mid-1800s, if not earlier, where it basically is an expression meaning that something has gone wrong, been ruined, failed, or lost. Apparently, it's even still common nowadays. Still used in the first fifth of the 21st century, I guess you could say. Or, right, 21st century we're in right now. Trying to remember what century we're in.
Yeah.
And at this point, you know, he gets very frustrated, crumples up the page, and bangs on the table. And at this point, and then Smitty puts his hand over his face. I think he's trying to stop from laughing. That's what it looks like. You know, it could be interpreted that he's a little embarrassed, but I think he's just trying to first not laugh at the fact that Donald Pleasance just screamed and banged on the table. That's my interpretation, at least, of this.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he goes, "I'm sorry, Colin," and, you know, Donald Pleasance then returns to the soft Colin that we already know and love, and immediately comforts him and says, "Ah, it's all right, Smitty, don't worry." What's 4 days up the bloody spout anyway, right?
Yeah.
And then Smitty puts his head in his hands, doesn't know what to do. And then Colin says, it's getting late. You push off the bed, I'll pack up here. Now, did you notice the way he looks at his watch?
Oh, okay.
He's looking at his watch.
Yeah.
And he is not focusing. He's already trying to show us that his character is having problems. But he's not even fazed by the fact that that he's not looking properly at his watch. You know, the question is he, did he close one eye and pick up and put the other one like right next to his eyes? Is that what the idea is?
Okay.
It's a very awkward way that he's doing.
Could it be that his right eye is much more possibly focused on, you know, closer to the watch, still a bit on the, you know, it's really, I mean, you know, his nose is really much pointing at, like, at the cuff on his sleeve, you know. Yeah. But
I mean, he looks cross-eyed the way
yeah,
that
I mean,
looking.
Maybe he's... Yeah. Yeah.
You know, cross-eyed Cullen. At this point, Smitty gives up and says, all right, Cullen, good night. I'm out of here. You know, I've had enough today.
Yeah, and there's the mixture of you know, saying sir to him, but then also calling him by his first name.
Yes.
It's pretty interesting.
So throughout the whole movie there's a mix of formality and informality. They're not consistent at all with the way they do this. And then he takes that piece of paper and crumples it up even more. So, I mean, you touched upon it a little bit at the beginning of the week, but like, what's your history with this week?
You know, there's probably a couple times where I bet my dad kind of saw that it was going to come on TV or it was coming on or it had already been on for maybe a half hour or so, but you know, he said it's still worth watching or what have you. So I mean, there's two or three watches probably that I kind of caught it when I was, you know, say in the, you know, 7 to 13 year old range.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was definitely one instance where in a, you know, like possibly late middle school or even early high school, whether it was, you know, we called it social studies for middle school.
Yes.
But then we got into, you know, actually giving it the more proper names of American history or world history and other things like that.
Exactly.
Where they would both have come into play, definitely for World War II. In one of those classes, I'm quite positive, you know, at least watching a good chunk of it, you know, there's very, very, very possible, you know, they just didn't end up showing the last 20 minutes because we've been watching it all week, you know,
yeah, I was gonna
for
say,
a period of a class at a time, and not even the whole period because it would be, you know, a 50 long minute period and we'd only really watch 40 minutes. The span of 40 minutes, you know, while the teacher talked for whatever reason before or after about something else shortly.
Yeah, I was actually going to mention the fact that if you saw it in class, it's taken like the entire week to see it.
Yeah,
right. You know, that type of thing. I mean, I had a teacher in social studies, I think it was in 7th grade, where his goal was to show us throughout the entire year, the entire school year, the entire miniseries of Centennial, which is 21 hours long.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, so every week or two, whatever it was, he would, you know, show us an hour and we would watch it and, you know, we would get to see a lot of the movie. And then midway through the year, he got in a car accident and then we never got to see the end of it.
Oh, no.
No, he was okay. He's actually okay now a professor in a university in, I think, Miami. I've always been meaning to reach out to him and tell him that I finally saw Centennial. I think like 2 years ago, I sat down and watched the whole thing over a period of like 2 or 3 days. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know, and now as an adult, I understand why he wanted to show it to us. You know, which is very interesting. So, Mr. M, if you're listening, I watched it. So is there anything about this entire movie in general that you want to mention, not just within these minutes?
It's kind of what you were getting at the beginning of the week, I think, too. It's just, you know, while it does have this range of emotions that kind of come across throughout, but it's the more general, uplifting, spirit of it, that it's, hey, work together and you can accomplish what feels like almost anything, something that seems like it should be impossible to try to get as many people out as they tried to, but, it's a success if just a couple few people can actually get out and not only just get out of the tunnel itself, but then further on and get fully away out of the country and out of the currently occupied German rule. And it's very much, in line with what we've talked about a little bit already about with Star Wars. It's clear good versus evil, and there's really very, very little seemingly gray area to it, and that kind of thing it hits me in my childhood sweet spot.
Right. I like the fact that this movie, I guess you can say, it's family friendly. They're mm-hmm. as we mentioned earlier in this week with the death of Ives, it's bloodyless. It's
mm-hmm.
a lot of the deaths are off screen as opposed to on screen, or there's no blood or anything like that. And they tell this compelling story that is a more adult story, obviously, because of what we're dealing with, but they still leave it open for kids to also enjoy it. I mean, myself, you mentioned also, and a number of other guests have mentioned, that most of us saw this movie for the first time when we were kids. Maybe not in its entirety, and my assumption is, and I can speak for myself, I doubt I understood most of what was going on at the time either. But it still was ingrained in me that it's such a compelling and fun movie to watch, despite the fact that it has a somewhat, that it has a tragic end, that they find ways to keep it so that it doesn't feel as tragic as it really is, and still entertain along the way by telling us, also giving us a history lesson. Well, thank you very much for joining us this week. I had a lot of fun. Hope you did.
Yeah, thank you.
And even more so, I hope our listeners did.
Yeah.
Do you want to, once again, for the final time this week, tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Definitely people should try to, hopefully, if they have some bit of a somewhat more musical interest, Almost Famous Minute and Feels Like Weezer are my two ongoing podcasts, and they're both on Pantheon Podcast Network, and you should check that out at pantheonpodcast.com. There's like 70 other shows there right now, roughly.
All right, and while you're doing that, you can go rate and review and subscribe on any podcatcher that you might be using to listen to this show. You can join our Facebook group, The Cooler. You can visit our website, thegreatescapeminute.com. Our email address is thegreatminute@gmail.com, and our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. So, hopefully everyone will have a great weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday. So until Monday, tally-ho!
Tally-ho!